Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to another exciting episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, straight from the Berlin set of the new Tom Cruise film Valkyrie, director, editor, and composer extraordinaire John Ottman. Also, esteemed television critic from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Rob Owen, will join the Movie Geeks to discuss the current state of television programming and how TV may be giving feature films a run for their money. And everyone's favorite segment, Flick Picks of the Week. Have a question for the geeks or any of tonight's exciting guests? Pick up the phone and give us a call. The number to dial is 718-508-9477. Now, it's time to strap in, turn it up, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome this Sunday evening to another episode of Movie Geeks United. This is Jamie, and we have Jerry and Chris here as well. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up? Word.
Sorry about the little delay. We were having some technical issues, so there was probably a little bit of silence after the Blog Talk Radio opening, but we're here. Everything's great. So how have you guys been since Wednesday evening?
Been pretty good.
Yeah, been all right.
Yeah, I know. Chris, you've been out surfing. You've been having a great time.
I did go surfing yesterday. Had a fantastic time, actually. It was perfect.
Great. I just a couple of programming notes. You can subscribe to our show through iTunes. If you look at the right-hand side of the screen, you'll see the iTunes icon there. Just click on that, and it'll take you to our iTunes page, or just look up Movie Geeks United in the iTunes search engine. It's absolutely free, and you can get caught up on all of our shows. You can download all of our podcasts from our Brian De Palma tribute, David Lynch, Al Pacino tributes, to the other wonderful guests that we've had on the show these past few months. And also, we've had a couple of people, quite a few people actually, place our broadcast on their website or their MySpace profile or their blog. If you want your very own Movie Geeks United broadcast, it's automatically updated with every new show. Just send us an email at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com, and we will in turn send you the code to place on your website or profile or blog, and you'll have your very own Movie Geeks United show. Isn't that just the coolest thing?
I like it. I do. I mean, you all think I'm being facetious, but I do like it.
Well, you know, you just sounded so enthusiastic about it. That's what amazed me.
You know, I try to amaze every show.
I actually like to. I think our show is great to make love to. Actually, I like to listen to it.
With the 30s porn music, right?
You like to make love to your own voice? Is that the?
Oh yeah, and yours, and yours too, Jerry.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. Let's talk film scores because we're going to be covering, speaking to a very acclaimed, just a great film composer and editor and director tonight, just someone that we all admire greatly. But let's talk about film scores. You know, obviously we all enjoy them. We all are crazy about them because we're all crazy about films, and it's an essential part of the magic of cinema are the scores. What are some of your favorite scores, Jerry?
Mine would have to be, well, my brother always gives me a hard time because I always just have the soundtracks to all these movies. He doesn't understand it, but obviously, Maurice Gerard's Lawrence of Arabia, Ennio Morricone, anything by Ennio Morricone, like
True.
Once Upon a Time in the West, or The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and anything by John Williams or Jerry Goldsmith. I mean, I'm just in love.
Yeah. Ennio Morricone also, his music has like a haunting quality that that no one else comes close to. I mean,
that's right.
That's his brand of music. It's just gorgeous. How about you, Chris?
I am a big Carter Burwell fan. I love Carter Burwell's scores, particularly Barton Fink. Fantastic music in that. And you know, the ones Jerry named too. I like, when it's distinctive, when it's something that really adds to the movie. Like, for instance, The Usual Suspects is a great example.
Oh, yeah.
That music is like so, it's just so dangerous sounding with these guys that try to pull this heist off, and that's a great score.
It's, and every score that populates this, our guest tonight, his resume is just amazing, and so chameleon-like. I mean, it's the music works so specifically for each film. For me, I've been collecting soundtracks since I was a kid. I know, Jerry, you've been the same way. And I have some kind of offbeat scores that I love. You know, everybody talks about John Williams and the big themes, Star Wars and Superman and what have you, but there's some quirky themes that I like of John Williams. There's the theme from Witches of Eastwick that I'm crazy about.
That's a good one.
I also really enjoy his themes that seem kind of Chopin-inspired. The Accidental Tourist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you recall that score. That's a great score. And I also really enjoy Presumed Innocent.
Oh, that's a good one, too.
And there's a... the composer's name escapes me. I think he's Japanese. For a film called The Sheltering Sky, it's just a beautiful, sweeping score.
To a beautiful movie.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very challenging movie. I could imagine.
And a challenging book, I may add.
Oh, yeah. It was one of those books that was considered unadaptable to film. But Bernardo Bertolucci...
leave it to him to do it.
He took the dare. So I'm really excited to be talking about film scoring and editing and directing tonight with our first guest. Our first guest tonight was declared in 1997 as one of Daily Variety's 50 People to Watch. And watch we have, as this remarkable and versatile talent has skyrocketed into the front ranks amongst the industry's finest film composers and editors. A graduate of the USC School of Cinema and Television, he fell into a working relationship with acclaimed director Bryan Singer, co-directing, editing, and performing sound design duties on Singer's short film Lion's Den, starring Ethan Hawke. His relationship with Singer paved the way for a series of landmark projects, including scoring and editing duties on his films Public Access, The Usual Suspects, Apt Pupil, X-Men 2, Superman Returns, and Singer's upcoming film starring Tom Cruise, Valkyrie. Other unforgettable scores that grace his resume include The Cable Guy, Gothica, Fantastic Four, Halloween H2O, and Urban Legends Final Cut, a film he also edited and directed. There's nothing that this man cannot do and do with unparalleled skill and boundless imagination. You can hear his latest composition from the upcoming Nicole Kidman, Daniel Craig thriller The Invasion when it's released in music stores this Tuesday, August 14th. It is a great honor to welcome one of our favorite creative talents in the film industry, Mr. John Ottman. Mr. Ottman, are you there?
I'm here. I hope you can hear me.
We can hear you great.
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. I installed this Skype thing on my computer because it's midnight here, and to call you guys, I'd have to drive over to the editing room on a Sunday night, which I didn't want to do, but I would have if this didn't work. So.
No, we appreciate you going out of your way and taking time to speak to us tonight. We're very appreciative of that. Let's start from the beginning. I read that you used to create sci-fi movies in a little makeshift studio you created in your parents' garage, and inevitably they would all be structured around some of your favorite scores. So I'm wondering, who are your greatest inspirations in the film composing world at the time, and what were some of those scores?
It's the obvious two, John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith. I'm the typical story of my age group, where when I saw Star Wars, it woke me up to film scores. And then I became a sort of a Williams fan for a moment, but then I saw Alien and immediately sort of like, who's this? And then, of course, Star Trek the Motion Picture just immediately made me a Goldsmith fanatic. And yeah. Love Williams, but I was sort of, Goldsmith became my idol. And so And then, you know, and then say what you will about the early James Horner, but nevertheless, he did a lot of great stuff back then. And you know, because I was a Goldsmiths fan, I always thought it was great when he would take Goldsmiths material and use it in his early movies. And so I really, the three of them I would use to score my you know, films when I was growing up and into my student films and so forth. And really that was what I couldn't wait to do, and a lot of times, as a lot of writers do, I would listen to their music and come up with stories just to accommodate the scores I love.
Right. Yeah, that's a great group to be in the company of.
Yeah.
How would you describe the role of a film composer?
Tortured soul. abused, lackey. No, a film composer, how do I describe the role? Well, I mean, obviously, it's extremely important. I always say, for most films, the composer is the person who provides the soul of the movie. Mm. And it's a tough position to be in because it's the last great hope of the filmmakers. Everything they've tried has been done, and all eyes look to you to fix everything, you know.
Yeah.
Or maybe the film will get better, or maybe it'll get screwed up. And so either way, you're really looked at with a lot of scrutiny, and so it's a tremendous amount of pressure.
Yeah. Is there a danger? I suppose there is. We've seen examples of it, I'm sure. But is there a danger of overpowering the image with the score? And how do you keep that from happening?
Never. No. the way you keep it from happening is usually trying to convince the executives not to let it happen, because I would say most composers, would rather be more subtle or not score a sequence. Especially me, I mean, I come to it from a sort of filmmaking point of view as well as an editor and so forth, and so I really try to, you know, as much as you can, do as intelligently as an approach as possible. But, you know, you're at the mercy of a lot of other people who are paranoid about their film, and they feel like if there's a moment of silence, the audience is going to get out of their chairs and run for the door.
Mm.
You know, and so it's really it's something that I think a lot of us would like to do, is to be less heavy-handed than we're asked to.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about your editing and your directing experiences as well. But in terms of film scoring, what is the process? What questions do you have to ask? And what sense do you have to have before you can begin to formulate that initial theme?
it's tough. I don't really, it's hard to describe how it all comes about, but for most projects, what I'll do is I need to create the basic themes of the film before I start writing the score. And even though that's a really labor-intensive it's a process that takes a lot of discipline to make yourself do, but it pays off in the end for me, because then it's the well from which I draw from for the score, and it makes the scoring of the film a lot more easy, and it makes sense to me to write the score based upon themes that I've established, you know.
Yeah.
So what I do is I make this personal overture to the movie, which I don't really play for anybody, because it's really a terrible sounding thing, and it has themes that are just in their very raw, rudimentary state. And as I start scoring the film, I start discovering how to develop them, or sometimes I'll dump a theme, but it gives me something to go on. If that answers your question, I don't know.
Well, if you take your latest work for The Invasion, when you saw Rush's, or you saw the work in progress, what is it about it that grabbed you, and what were some of the initial ideas you had to set music to it?
Well, The Invasion is a weird example, actually. The Invasion is the one example that sort of negates everything I just told you. It's actually the one film I've done, there might be another, that just is not very thematic at all. I mean, I really love writing themes and try to be as lyrical as I can with the scores. And Invasion was one that just didn't lend itself to that kind of score. It would have been silly. And, you know, they're trying to make this edgy and as interesting as possible. And if we did a traditional score, it would really kind of cheesify it, you know. And I was trying to run against the cheese grain, as it were. So
yeah.
It's really a non-thematic score, but so the challenge was, how do I do a score that the director often wanted to be droney and sustainy and have it be interesting at the same time, and hope that actually when it's on an album won't be a total bore, which is, you know, not why we write scores, it's for the movie, you know, which is one of my pet peeves, how people critique the film score albums, you know, and judge the score based upon the album when it could have been horrible on the movie, but sounds great on the album, you know.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, the art of film music is really, it's a different animal musically. It's manipulation of visuals and how to bring things from under the surface that are being talked about and to clarify things in a pragmatic way for the audience and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's not really, there's a couple of minor themes in the film that reflect the subject matter that's being talked about in the movie, but it's really quite, it's just sort of a bizarre score. And for me, it was fun because it's very electronically driven, which is not my normal thing to do. So that was a lot of fun for me to sort of, you know, research sounds and make up new synthesized sounds and so forth.
Yeah. Well, you've done, I know The Invasion is a version of The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which has been made into four, this is probably the fifth film.
Oh, this is the fourth version.
Fourth incarnation of it, and
yeah.
All of the films have been so excellent throughout the years. It seems to be a theme that's very malleable throughout each era. But I know you've also composed scores for other pre-existing films that have these iconic themes like Superman or Halloween. When you're working on a project like that, is it more or less challenging than starting from scratch?
I would say it's just as challenging, especially Superman, because I wanted to write an original score, and at the same time, it would be, as a fan of Superman, it would be sacrilegious not to use that theme, and I would probably be assassinated by people like me who are fans of the genre. So the challenge was to, you know, keep the theme alive, but also acknowledge that it was a new film and new generation, and to try to do my own material. And I sometimes get depressed because I wrote, you know, I don't know what I wrote, 100 minutes of music plus for that film, and it's sort of bookended by the John Williams theme. In between is a tremendous amount of material I wrote, and you know, sometimes it gets dismissed because
no, but it was very good though.
I'm sorry?
It was very good what you brought to it. I mean, you really, really, like, not homage, but you really added a lot to Williams' original score, I thought, in that film.
I'm crazy about that score.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. You know, I mean, as a movie fan, it drives me crazy when I go see a film, even like when I went to see Wild Wild West, and it wasn't bum-bum-ba-dum-bum-bum. I was like, what happened? And then I could still, you know, or even Spider-Man. You know, I was expecting when I went to that film that would be a big orchestral version of the Spider-Man theme from the series, and so I'm really strict that way. And when I just expect to hear the theme, or like Lost in Space, I wanted to hear the John Williams theme. And instead, it was like a rap song at the end of the
right.
You know, and that stuff drives me crazy. So I had to do what was right, you know. And a lot of times I think, you know, composers' egos come into play and they want to do their own theme. And sure, we all do. I mean, I would love to have had my own theme flying across the screen with, you know, credits and so forth, but it'd be wrong, you know.
Right, right. For those of us who aren't musically talented, of course I'm not talking about myself, but are there examples of certain instruments that you can use to express a certain emotion, and are you constantly looking for a way to kind of escape those limitations and be more experimental?
Yeah, I mean, you're always trying to push yourself and find different ways of skinning the cat, you know. And I don't know. There's one particular instrument that harkens a particular feel. I mean, it's really hard. I can't really say. Because every single instrument I use, I've used in both ways. You know, you could say, "Oh, the oboe can be pretty, but it can also be exotic and Middle Eastern." The two. I mean, it depends
right.
on how you. I mean, the cello is actually one of the most beautiful instruments in the orchestra, as far as I'm concerned. But that too can be creepy, or it can be the most beautiful thing in the world.
Right, right. Temp scoring. What do you believe that that's harmful to the process?
I believe both. I mean, it's obviously it's something that has to happen because when you screen the film, well, when the editor screens the film for the director, he wants to sort of make his sequences fly and show them how it's going to work. And the music sometimes temp music will help. And when you show the studio the film, obviously it can't just be dry. You've got to have music on it, and the type of music you have will show the studio what direction you're going, what kind of score you're looking for. Mm-hmm. And we all know what the negative is. The negative is the temp love scenario where everyone gets so used to something that it's in the film, and if the film's going well, it's a security blanket for everybody. And the mm-hmm. poor composer comes on, and they say, "Well, this is what we want." And what's frustrating for the composer, especially a composer really has a conviction in his craft, is he watches the movie and realizes that, yeah, this particular, you know, piece of music works, but it's really not right for the sequence. But all the filmmakers can't get their head around the fact that it's not right because they now have forever associated that piece of music with
right.
the movie. And if you're lucky enough to have a really close relationship with a director like Brian, you can actually, you know, when I'm scoring the film, I can say, you know what, look him in the eye and say, "This, I know you like this, but it's really wrong, and here's what I've done," and he'll actually listen to me. But, you know, it's not every composer has that kind of relationship with the directors they work for.
What kind of relationship are you looking for from a director? What is the ideal working relationship?
Well, the director just says, "Do what you want. I'm going to Hawaii." And I'll see you on the dub stage. No, basically the bottom line is you want someone who trusts you, and whether even if it's not a director or a filmmaking team that you even worked with before, when you walk into a project and people trust you, it means the world, at least for me, it means the world to me, and it makes my creative juices flow.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm under some, you know, Gestapo boot or something, and it makes me want to create more. And there have been projects where I get on and they look at you and like, "Who the hell are you?" And we really wanted so-and-so, but we had to settle for you. And it just grows as a cancer, and those projects usually don't work out really well.
Yeah. You're a very accomplished film editor as well, fantastic film editor. Is there a similarity between composition and editing for you in the sense of possibly establishing a rhythm?
Well, maybe subliminally, I'd like to say that I'm this savant that sits there and while I'm editing and I'm actually thinking of the score, but I'm not. I mean, when you're a film editor, it's an all-encompassing job, and you're desperately trying to keep up with the shooting as you're cutting the scenes. And then even after they've been shooting, as you know, you're editing for a couple months to get the cut together. And when I'm cutting, I will purposefully design a sequence that I know will be a score-driven moment. But what the score is actually going to be, I have no idea, and it's always that looming task that I have to do when I'm also the editor. One of the few times that I actually used or thought of the music before I was editing the sequence was the scene in The Usual Suspects, because we had these awful second unit shots of planes landing at the I think it's JFK, and barely any of the plane shots were any good because the camera kept shaking and they were just awfully shot. So I thought, okay, the only way to get these planes down is to do jump cuts. So, and I knew that if I'm going to make these jump cuts, I've got to make sure that whatever the music is, it's got to hit these cuts exactly. And so what I did is I cut the sequence to a click track. I thought, well, as long as these are hitting the clicks, whenever I compose the score, as long as I'm composing these exact clicks or beats, as it were, then it would work, and it ends up working. Although, you know, a lot of people know the trivia is that I think a 747 is approaching and an L-1011 lands. And frankly, I admit that I didn't even notice, you know.
Yeah. I've read your rant on kind of the underappreciated contribution of the film editor that you have on your website. do you think that has to do with the nature of editing being kind of an invisible art?
Yeah, absolutely. And well, it's not only invisible, it's also completely baffling to anyone. I mean, if you ask anyone on the street what a film editor is, they'll think it's just some person who takes things out of a movie. And a lot of that is because when we watch television, it says this has been edited for television, so people think, oh, that's supposed to be what an editor is, the guy who takes things out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and so when I meet friends and people ask me, what do you do? And I go, well, I try to just put an all-encompassing sort of because you can't really explain what editing is. It's so complicated. So I just say, well, you know, an editor of a magazine or a newspaper, that's the same thing on a movie. I mean, the editor is the person who is in charge of the production pretty much. I mean, he's the liaison between the director and the producers, or definitely the director in the studio many times. And you're the guy who's gonna take all the stuff and make a movie out of it. And you're the guy that's got to go down to the set and say, hey, I need this shot, or this isn't working, or you know X, Y, and Z. So you know, I speak for all editors out there, since I'm a reluctant one, and I'm not I don't care if I burn bridges or whatever. I just think it's such an underappreciated field, at least among the masses. I mean, the sad thing is if. The only people that really appreciate the miracles you've accomplished in the editing room are those people who were involved in the movie mm-hmm. and know what you were dealt.
Yeah,
exactly. And so it's not something you can take away from the film and say, hey, Mom and Dad, here's my work, like you can a film score. You can put it on a CD at least if mm-hmm. they can hear it. But, mm-hmm. you know, film editing, you don't know what the heck it is, you know.
Yeah, that's so true. Your film, you directed Urban Legends Final Cut, as well as edited the film and composed the score. How did you take to directing? Is it something that you're anxious to do again? And what surprised you most about the process?
I loved it. I would love to do it again. It's one of these classic stories where I'm in house debt, and you know, when you start making money, you start spending too much, and so I'm in the situation where I got to keep scoring and editing films or scoring films before I can make that leap and take a risk of directing again. To be frank, because it's you know, when you score a bad movie, you can crawl out from the rocks and keep working your career, but when you direct one that fails, even if it's a good film. It's much harder to pick up the pieces as a director.
Right.
And so it's a scary thing to do. I mean, everyone tells me I'm crazy to be afraid of going back into it because I can always fall back on two other careers. But nevertheless, you know, but I really, really enjoyed it a lot. I mean, I had the lamest script ever. I shouldn't say this. But it was a fine movie.
Awesome. I enjoyed it.
My main contribution to the film was making something that was, as Teen Horror is anyway, massively ludicrous and unbelievable, actually somewhat plausible. And that was my main contribution. There are a lot of sequences in that film I'm extremely proud of. But you know, as a whole, when you put it together, it's a dumb teen horror movie. And, you know, but I'm proud of the job we did. And my favorite part of the process was I guess, being able to interact with people, which you don't get to do a lot in the editing room or even as a composer. And I loved working with the actors. And part of the frustration of scoring, and especially editing films, is when you're sitting there in the editing room and you're like, God damn it, if I had been able to talk to this actor, I would have done X, Y, and Z. And so I finally was able to do that, and it was a lot of fun.
Well, I personally would be first in line to see whatever film you decide to direct next. But before you go, I have to ask you about Valkyrie. You're on location with the team editing and scoring this particular picture in Berlin. And I've heard that this picture has a, kind of a great escape feel. Is that accurate?
A great escape feel. Well, I guess. I mean, we've only been shooting 3 weeks or so, and it's, I don't know. I guess a great escape feel in terms of it's a period piece. It's a lot
right.
of big outdoor scenes. I don't know. I mean, it's more. I mean, it's really more of a thriller and a sort of ticking clock kind of thing. You know, a conspiracy movie,
right.
More than The Great Escape, I think. But the footage we're getting is fantastic because you know it was pitched. Brian called me, the director. You know, pitched to this to me. You know, a few months ago, and he's like, you know, okay, this is a little movie we're doing. It's maybe like you know $15 million, and I really want you to do it with me. Of course. Then I get the footage of the first couple of days, and it's like these World War II planes and Messerschmitts flying over and these big vistas, and I'm like, holy shit, this thing looks like it's a $100 million movie, and they've really gone through a lot of pains to give it the largest canvas as they can, because it is a very, as Suspects was, and it's the same writer, it's a very dialogue-heavy, very dense movie about conspiratorial tactics, you know. And so there's a lot of internal claustrophobic sequences, I think, and it's smart to sort of at least when it does go outside to make it feel bigger because I think it'll help, as they say, open up the movie.
Well, and Tom Cruise it's a Tom Cruise film. He stars in it, and it seems like a fantastic role for him, something that a great actor such as Tom Cruise can really sink his teeth into. How has his performance been shaping in your eyes from what you've seen the past few weeks?
What am I supposed to say?
I want some sort of scoop on this.
No, you know, he's doing a great job. You know, we just started, and what I didn't realize is when he was cast for the part, I thought, oh, that's kind of weird, you know, casting Tom Cruise as his part. Then I saw the picture of Stauffenberg, and actually he was about the same age and is very strikingly handsome guy, and so it actually, you know, it's a chiseled look and the whole bit, so it actually makes sense for him to do the role. So,
yeah.
So I was like, oh, this makes total sense. And the surrounding actors are just great. I mean, you know, we got Terrence Stamp, we have Zod himself in the film. we've got this guy Bill Nighy, who's amazing. Yeah, and I didn't know who he was because I don't really watch a lot of movies. And I'm just in the editing room going, oh my god, I can't wait for the footage to come to this guy because he's just a thrill. He's like, I call him like the Fenster of this movie, you know, the character Fenster from Usual Suspects. He's given himself all these like facial tics and these like these murmurs on his face because he's like this nervous wreck of his general. And it's hilarious. He's really good. Tom Wilkinson hasn't started shooting yet, and he's great. I can't wait to get that. So Kenneth Branagh is really great. So it's like it's just really great cast.
What a cast!
That
wow.
is quite a cast.
Wow. Well, I cannot.
Yeah. So that's got me.
I'm sorry. I cannot wait to see that movie. And that comes out next fall. Is that when we can expect that?
Yeah. Apparently August. I think 18th or something like that. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a fast project. I mean, it's going to be put together quickly, so I'm a little freaked out about that. But you know, I don't know how I'm supposed to pull the score out of my ass, and that's what I'm trying to
tell. Oh, you'll do fine.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it'll be an unforgettable piece of work from you, like always. But Mr. Altman, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and
sure.
We very much appreciate it. And you have an open invitation. Come back to us anytime you'd like.
Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Bye-bye now.
Yeah,
that
bye.
Is John Ottman, composer, editor, film director, an amazing talent, and really exciting to hear about Valkyrie, isn't it, guys?
Yes, it is.
That's a movie that I'm really anxiously anticipating. It looks fantastic, and what a cast.
That's quite
cast.
A cast. I guess, is Branagh going to play one of the... Branagh plays a Nazi so well,
yes.
So I'm very... That should be very interesting.
Which that usually would not be a compliment, but
no, but he does. He is good at playing these evil. You know, you want some even like something like Swing Kids. He's great.
Yeah. He is great, and he's having a resurgence now. If you've noticed, he's really back in the spotlight. He's directing the remake of Sleuth with Michael Caine and Jude Law.
That's quite a pairing. Jude Law and Michael Caine. It's very interesting.
And Kenneth Branagh directing. I mean, that's amazing. And he just directed, I think, As You Like It for
HBO.
Speaking of HBO, we're on to our topic of the week. That was such a smooth segue, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
The world of television has undergone a number of exciting and interesting changes over the past few years, not the least of which is the rapidly closing gap between the prestige of the small screen and the big screen. More and more high-profile cinematic talents are flocking to television. Television programming is also enjoying a popularity surge in the DVD market as well, and in cineplexes across the country, moviegoers are being flooded with a barrage of feature films based on some of our most beloved TV shows. Here to discuss these and other developments in the television world is the esteemed TV critic for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, author of the book Gen X TV, The Brady Bunch to Melrose Place, and the president of the Television Critics Association, Mr. Rob Owen. Let me get this line up real quick. Mr. Owen, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You are very welcome, but one thing I do want to correct, I am no longer president of the Television Critics Association.
Okay. At one time you were, though.
I was until July 21st or 22nd, and then my term was up, and we have a great new president, Dave Walker of the New Orleans Times-Picayune.
Oh, excellent. I'm fascinated by your job and what your job entails. There's so many episodes of so many shows. And how many hours a day on average are you watching television?
It really varies wildly. I would say, you know, there are 3 hours in prime time. So let's say I watch 4 hours attentively, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Part of my job also involves watching and critiquing local television news, and that I may not always be paying as close attention to unless it's a sweeps month, and then I have to. But so let's say 4 hours on average.
Okay.
But it's often more than that, and, you know, there's the stuff I watch for my own interest and hobby, and then there's the stuff I watch purely for work, so it can run the gamut.
Yeah. I definitely want to discuss some of those shows that you personally admire the most. But there was a time, and I suppose it still exists, when television actors could not wait to break into the realm of feature films. And now it seems more and more high-profile people from the film industry are flocking to television.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, by and large, there is better television being made today than there are movies.
Mm.
I mean, when you look at the stuff that the mainstream studios especially are putting into the Cineplex, you know, a lot of it leaves a lot to be desired. It's aimed at a young male teen demographic, which isn't to say that that's going to make it bad, but unfortunately, sometimes it does. So I think that television has just reached a maturity level. I think that particularly with the rise of cable networks and everyone in cable now wanting to do original scripted series to brand themselves, you know, those folks are more willing to take chances. They don't require as huge an audience as a NBC or a CBS. So I just think there's a creative freedom that TV affords folks who maybe were more known for their movie work in the past.
Yeah, and the actors, usually when actors are asked that question, they always respond to just the level of writing.
Right.
So much stronger in TV.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's what they say. And I think by and large I think it's true. I don't think it's just a line.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, when you have somebody like Holly Hunter, who's obviously been very choosy about her film roles, opting to do TV, part of it may be that I think we have seen a trend of actresses over age 40 opting for television because of, perhaps in part, because of the movie studio's emphasis on the young adult male audience, and those folks aren't going to get hired to be in those movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly examples of actors who fit very comfortably in the TV medium, but don't necessarily translate into feature films.
Oh, that's true too. Yeah.
Does it work? Has it worked the other way around? Are there motion picture actors who don't work on the small screen?
I mean, we've certainly had failures in that regard. I remember a couple years ago, CBS tried a sitcom with Bette Midler that didn't work.
Well, that didn't last long at all.
No, I think it was like 6 episodes and canceled or something. But and there are plenty of others, not that I'm thinking of them off the top of my head right now, but there certainly have been plenty that haven't worked. But again, I'm not sure if that's the function of those people being movie stars and somehow too big for TV, or more often than not, when a TV show fails, it fails because of the writing. It succeeds because of the writing, it fails because of the writing.
Well, in feature films, you have the opening weekend, and if you don't perform on the opening weekend, you're gone. What's kind of the timeline for shows? It seems like you're on for maybe three weeks, and if you don't perform, you're gone.
Yes and no. I mean, sometimes that's the case, but oftentimes it's not. I mean, you look at a show like Friday Night Lights that, you know, didn't really perform at all during its first season, and yet it's coming back for a second season.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a case, I think, of network executives having faith that, you know, the show deserves more of a chance. Maybe we marketed it the wrong way. It was through no fault of the show's that it didn't succeed. But then you have other shows, like it was, I think, 2 Januaries ago that ABC premiered the Heather Graham series.
Oh, they didn't give that much of a chance.
Yeah, one episode. And
yeah, that was it. I remember.
And in that case, it was because, you know, they ordered the show started production, they saw the episodes. They saw the episodes weren't getting better, so they just said, okay, let's cut our losses.
Right, right. And it's very affirming to see that some studios, because obviously Friday Night Lights has gotten rave reviews. It's a show that is of high quality. It's nice to see that they recognize that. And on the other side as well, Jericho, due to the viewer protest, they brought that show back because
right.
it's a big viewer favorite. It that's kind of nice to see the studios paying attention to.
It is, but don't think them too altruistic. In the case of Friday Night Lights, NBC owns the show, so they have a financial stake in wanting to see it succeed. Had that show been owned by Sony, produced by Sony for NBC, would it have been renewed? I think that's a different question altogether.
Yeah, yeah.
Why not Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip?
Well, there's one... owned by Warner Brothers.
So they wouldn't care about that.
Well, yes, but I also think that creatively no one was particularly happy with the way Studio 60 was going. I think that they didn't see it as... I think they just felt like the American audience had rejected it, whereas in the case of Friday Night Lights, I think the feeling was not enough people sampled it to have rejected it.
Right. No, that's understandable. And I also think because also NBC had 30 Rock, which turned out to be a bigger hit.
Right. Certainly a bigger critical hit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, Studio 60, it's so kind of sad to me because Aaron Sorkin is an amazing writer. He's one of our top writers, I believe.
He is.
The show just, it never took off. It just, there was so much promise there, and it just never... cross the finish line.
I think the problem with Studio 60 was largely that Americans could buy the idea of idealistic folks working in the White House and could get behind the notion of a romanticism of that.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of how hard people in the entertainment industry work, people in large swaths of America are never going to look at what they do and get behind the idea that somehow what they're doing is, you know, for the betterment of mankind. And I think Studio 60 tried to put over a tone that it was, and I think America said, no, it's not.
I think you're probably absolutely right about
good,
that.
Good point.
How influential has HBO been in changing the landscape of television programming?
Oh, hugely influential. I mean, you just have to look at FX, which is the basic cable, or has become the basic cable HBO. There's no question that you know, there was a couple years ago, it was not long after The Sopranos premiered, that Bob Wright, who was then a big muckety-muck at NBC, wrote a memo saying, you know, why can't we do this stuff? We should be doing this sort of thing. So clearly HBO has had a big influence. And so have the other cable networks that have, you know, started taking up that banner. I think the fact that FX was successful in... to some degree copying the HBO formula and making it work for basic cable, you know, I think that said, well, HBO can do it, FX can do it, so therefore we at CBS can push the envelope more with Swingtown, which is coming up at mid-season.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think all those things have an impact.
HBO also started the DVDs. I think it was the Sopranos that they got the idea to package it in a DVD.
Yeah, I'm not sure who actually did the first TV shows on DVD, but I think because HBO, you had to pay for it monthly, and some people didn't do that, so they bought the DVDs instead. And I think that was how TV on DVD sort of grew into such a huge thing, because, oh, we didn't see it because we didn't subscribe to HBO, which later begat, oh, we didn't watch that the first season, we'll watch it on DVD for even broadcast network shows.
It's a nice way to get acquainted with some of these shows that you have missed.
It's very smart.
Personally, for me, 24, which is ideal for the DVD format.
Absolutely.
I got hooked on 24 by watching the DVD, and in turn, Chris, I think you've gotten hooked on Lost because of the DVDs of that show.
Oh, yeah. Huge.
I think it works much better without the commercials, both of those shows.
Yeah, and both of those shows are, you have to see what happens next, you know?
Right.
They're such cliffhangers, so that you could very easily just play the next episode. It's ideal. So, Mr. Owen, what are some of your current favorite shows?
You know, the tough thing about being a TV critic is that there are so many. It is really hard to find time to watch all of them. So right now, top of mind is Mad Men on AMC, which is a new series about guys at an advertising agency in New York in 1960. And it's from a writer of The Sopranos, and it's just incredibly well done. You know, it's a drama, but there's a lot of comedy in the drama from the time travel aspect where, you know, you see everybody smoking and then a guy's walking up the stairs and hacking his lungs out. You know, it's very well done. It's got a great cast of either unknowns or sort of semi-unknowns.
Right.
Some folks you may recognize, but it's well written. They've started developing the characters. So I definitely love that show in particular right now.
Yeah, I saw that AMC last week, they had, I suppose it's a mini-series event, The Company? Is that the name?
Oh, that was TNT.
TNT.
Yeah, I wasn't wild about The Company, but it was an interesting concept and a good attempt, and I always, you know, am happy to see networks trying to do something new and maybe a little bit different, even if they don't always succeed.
Yeah, and you talk about it. We're talking about movie stars doing more and more television. It's a fantastic cast. Michael Keaton and Alfred Molina.
Sure.
And even Chris O'Donnell. I'll throw him into the mix. As
well. Yeah, the way
you
said that.
Yeah, I said that with a little bit of reservation. But, my current favorite, and Chris, I think it's probably yours now, too, is Big Love.
Oh, I love Big Love.
I'm crazy about this.
I am, too. I think it's a fantastic show. I think this season has been excellent. I mean, I loved the first season, too. I never thought, I mean, I looked at it when I first heard about it, and I'm like, ugh, polygamist, icky,
right.
I don't know that I'll like this. And it's turned out to be a fascinating character study.
Yeah.
No, I am with you 100% on that.
Chris and I were actually talking about the second season. It seemed like the first episode, it started really slow. And but now it seems like they made a laundry list of every domestic and social problem that family can go through, and they're just crossing the dilemmas out one by one, and it's just taken a fantastic turn, and it's another one of those big cliffhanger shows for me. I just can't get enough of it.
And again, you have actors who were not TV actors before they started the series.
Mm-hmm.
Chloe Sevigny especially is just a revelation, and
yeah, she's,
you know,
great on that. I mean, she's just a wonder.
Yeah. The other HBO show that Jerry, I know you, well, we're all fond of it, but Jerry, I know that you talk about it very often, is Entourage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's see, Entourage, and I guess the other two shows that I like now, since so many of the other ones are off the air for good, are Rescue Me and Weeds, which starts tomorrow night.
Right.
Weeds is excellent.
Weeds is superb.
Yeah.
Weeds is like American Beauty, but done right.
Oh,
perfectly.
I agree with you 100%.
I don't think I've ever seen the suburbs portrayed as perfectly as I have on Weeds. It is just, there's nothing wrong with that portrayal. I understand it all too well. No, but going to Entourage, though, I didn't think Entourage would last as long as I did. It's not very realistic. It's, you know, my brother and I were talking about this a couple weeks ago. It's just nothing on that show is realistic, but yet somehow it has you hooked. It's like this car crash involving porn stars. You can't not look at it.
And
what I like about this season has finally touched on the reality of the show. They're all leeches. They're all blood-sucking leeches.
Yeah.
And finally, this season, they finally hit on it. Not in a mean way. We love these guys. They're all irresistible. They're all very charming. But let's face it, all these guys surrounding Vince are leeches.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think Entourage it's never been a show of substance, necessarily.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it's all just all about looks and everything.
And
it's very pretty.
And you don't watch it for that. You watch it because it's the breeziest 30 minutes on TV.
Oh, it is, and it has something else going for it, though. And I guess you could say that Jeremy Piven is the James Gandolfini of the show. While known before the show for certain parts, he's come into his own as Ari Gold, who is a nicer, if you could say it, a nicer version of his real-life alter ego, Ari Emanuel.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that the last two seasons, Ari has become the central figure. He has a heart. They've made him human, which
right.
is a Hollywood agent who has a heart is unheard of. They're all just
the
most despicable characters in the world.
Yeah.
But he is just, he has come through in ways that I can't even comprehend yet. It's amazing.
Yeah. Mr. Owen, what are some of your, have you seen many of the new fall shows?
I've pretty much seen all of them that they've made available to us so far.
Any standouts among that group?
The one that I think is most interesting, but that I have concerns about as a series, is Pushing Daisies on ABC.
Oh, okay.
It's a fantastic pilot. It's sort of this magical realism, kind of like in Big Fish or Edward Scissorhands. It's directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, the film director, written by Brian Fuller, who's done Wonderfalls and Dead Like Me and Root for Heroes last season.
Mm.
And it's just a really great show. It's about this guy who, when he touches people who are dead, he can bring them back to life. But then if he touches them again, they die forever. And it's just got this fairy tale element to it that's great.
Mm.
But my question is, can they do it on a weekly basis, not just in terms of the budget and the production design and the look of the show, but also the storytelling? Because one of the things we've seen in TV in recent years is that there are shows that are hugely cinematic and could be movies, and maybe should be movies rather than ongoing television series.
Mm-hmm.
So I have concerns about Pushing Daisies, but I love the pilot, and I'm eager to see more of it.
Okay.
I've seen, and that's an ABC show.
Yes.
I've seen a couple of things advertised off and on. Kelsey Grammer returning to TV sitcoms with, I think it's a show called Back to You.
Yep, it's set here in Pittsburgh.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, at a TV station here.
Have you seen any of that? And is that as funny as the previews make it out to be?
Yeah, I liked the pilot. I didn't love it. It's written by Steve Levitan, who did Just Shoot Me. And Levitan's comedy tends to toward sort of the smutty side of things, and sometimes unnecessarily so.
Right.
So I think that I had some concerns with the show in that respect. But certainly Kelsey Grammer and Patricia Heaton are excellent. Some of the supporting cast, again, I wasn't hugely wild about, but I am eager to see more episodes. I think it could do well. One of the things we've seen with television is that, like Studio 60, behind-the-scenes shows just always fail.
Mm-hmm.
Behind the scenes of Hollywood shows, that is.
Yeah, it seems to be a doomed genre.
But I don't think Back to You I don't think people will look at it that way, because even though it's set in a TV station newsroom, I think the stars are so big in Grammer and Heaton in terms of their TV past that I think that overwhelms any of the notion of it being a behind-the-scenes show.
Right. I had one more show to ask about, and that is Chuck.
Uh-huh.
That's an NBC show.
Yep.
How was that?
I liked the pilot. I'm eager to see more. I wasn't wild about many of NBC's pilots, but I did like that one. I think, this is sort of the fall of the nerd on TV, because we have lots of nerds and geeks on TV shows. It's
right.
Sort of this trend that's going on. And Zachary Levi, who plays the lead in Chuck, is very likable. So I think that it could turn and develop into something good. And that's the thing with the pilot. It's like
it's
watching
awesome.
The
yeah.
first 10 minutes of the movie.
Yeah,
and
yeah, that's true.
It could, turn out great, or it could be a huge disappointment. So, I always caution readers, this is a review of just the pilot,
right,
not
right.
the series.
Speaking of long, things that are built for longevity, I'm hoping that, and this is the last question I have to ask you, I'm hoping that this reality TV trend will run its course. Because it seems like you have these high-quality, intelligent programming on TV, and on the other side you have all the reality shows, just
right.
a barrage of them. And I know that they're done because they get high ratings, and they're very cheap to produce as well. But what's your take on the current state of TV programming? Are you pessimistic or optimistic?
My feeling as far as reality TV goes is that, yes, most of it's junk, and the networks have seen, not entirely, because some reality shows this summer have done okay for them, but many of them have done terrible. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why you're seeing a show like The Closer get 7 million viewers a week, and then a show like, which I actually like as reality goes, On the Lot on Fox has gotten like 2 million viewers a week or 3 million.
Yeah.
And I actually like On the Lot because I think the filmmakers on there are quite talented. And that show has found its way, but I'm probably the only person you'll find who would say that. But, no, I think reality TV is a genre, like sitcoms are a genre, like dramas are a genre. I don't think it's going to go away. I think it will change. I think it will mutate. And you just, you know, you just ignore it. You know, it's like those crappy movies that are dumped into the dumped into theaters that, you know, you just don't go see them. And that's my feeling towards reality shows. You just don't watch them. You don't support them.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
The bad ones. There are some good ones. I will say that.
There are some that I enjoy. They're time wasters. You know, they don't do anything to inspire your mind. But I really appreciate you being a part of our show this evening, and please come back to us sometime to talk about some more television.
I would be happy to. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you
so much.
Take care.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye.
That's Rob Owen, the television critic for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Fantastic guest, fantastic conversation. All right, guys, we have less than 4 minutes. Are you guys ready to do your flick picks?
Yes. Yes, we are.
You sound so tentative tonight, Jerry.
I didn't even sound, I said yes. I mean, all right, okay, whatever.
We could put our shows on other people's websites. Yeah, I think that's really great.
I didn't think I sounded that way, but okay, we're killing time here. That's not good. All right.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
I know.
What's your flick pick this week, Jerry?
Okay, well, actually, it's like 6 degrees of John Ottman tonight, so let's do that. The movie that I'm picking tonight, actually, last week a very important revelation was made. Adolf Hitler, in his record collection, listened to music by Jewish and Russian composers. This is actually a big deal, huge deal, because everyone thought it was just Richard Wagner.
Yeah,
and well, the movie I'm picking this week is Oliver Hirschbogel's *The Downfall*,
mm-hmm.
and he is one of the directors of this week's *The Invasion* that comes out. And I say one of because I believe it's actually the Wachowski brothers took over the movie.
He's the only credited director.
Yes, but there are other hands at work.
Yes.
But I picked this movie because it's brilliant, and it is the first time probably since *The Desert Fox* with James Mason that Adolf Hitler is portrayed not as caricature. The Alec Guinness movie, Hitler, The Last 10 Days, as a comedy, is brilliant. Anthony Hopkins in The Bunker, well, it's kind of like the companion piece to his movie Magic. He's just twitching the whole time, but they're both laughable performances. But leave it to Bruno Ganz, who played the nicest character in German cinema, the angel in Wings of Desire, to play its most monstrous character, Adolf Hitler.
And
The Downfall is probably one of the most brilliant film depictions of Nazism, World War II, and Adolf Hitler himself.
Mm. Yeah, I'm interested in seeing that. I haven't checked it out yet, but I passed it by in the video store several times and picked it up, and it's just been a question of being in the mood to watch a film about Hitler.
it's not so much about being. It is very engrossing, and it's just it will suck you in.
Yeah,
it really will.
You know, speaking of Hitler, did you see the film Max?
Oh yes.
That Hitler at one time. Could have chosen to become an artist?
Well, that's the whole thing. I always used to joke in high school that the fuckers at the Vienna Art School ruined everything for us. They should have just accepted him.
Yeah.
And this could have all been avoided.
Yeah. Chris, what's your flick pick this week?
Mine is Jake Kasdan's Zero Effect.
Oh, beautiful movie.
Really, really funny movie every time I watch it with Bill Pullman and Ben Stiller in what he does very well, playing the straight man. And actually Ryan O'Neal playing, if you can call him, a villain in the movie. but it's very funny, really fantastic script. And every time I watch it, I love it. I think it's one of those underrated movies that nobody saw. But I never liked Bill Pullman until I watched it, and I've always liked him since because he turns in a really quirky, weird, hilarious performance.
It's a great movie.
I've been at your house several times, and you've had that on. It's a movie that you continuously revisit.
Oh, yeah, my friends and I just are constantly quoting it back and forth to one another. It's a really quotable movie, too. Very funny script.
My pick this week is, I'm taking a risk. It's not a great film, but it's a very good one, a solid one. Lonely Hearts. It just came out on DVD last week.
Oh, I watched that last night, yeah.
Yeah, it's at times it plays a little like Seven, set in the 50s. It's very... It takes chances, you know. It goes where you don't think it will go on several occasions, and everyone's very strong in it. Particularly Salma Hayek, partly because she has the showiest part.
Yes, she does.
But she does it with great conviction. And Jared Leto, who I've never really appreciated, is very good in it as well. So that's my flick pick this week. We're out of time, guys. It's been a great fun show.
Yes, it has.
And we'll see everybody Wednesday night. The director of Good Luck Chuck, Mark Helfrich, and a stuntman from Indiana Jones 4, and many, many other great films will be here with us on Wednesday. Be a great show. Thanks for joining us, everybody, and to my co-hosts, we'll see you Wednesday.
Okay, good night, everyone.
Night.